Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. And this is Rick, and welcome to the call today. In just 1 minute, let's see. I'm looking for. There we go. So let's just begin with our questions today. Question number one. My wife and I are in our 6 months since full disclosure. We've done 911, EMS, EMS calls. My wife's doing an amazing amount of work to recover from this devastation that I caused her. While I'm doing men's fraternity groups and NA meetings to restore the manhood I lacked from my family and stay in recovery from my sexual addiction, some may think that just because of all that, things are solved. Perhaps I made the same mistake, but at times it seems I lack a great deal of compassion for her. When she's triggered and begins to express her emotional flood, I repeat the same pattern. First, I try to answer her questions, dealing with her emotional pain with a rational perspective. Then, since the conversation is not going anywhere, I get easily defensive, still trying to make my points, not hers. My ego is up, so she feels, and any words at this point are simply meaningless. My voice itself becomes like a sharp knife that is way worse than a protest polka, because even if I identify the dance, her emotional flood caused in the first place from my infidelity makes it not impossible to back up and pause without making the fight worse. What would you recommend to develop compassion and tolerance? Why do I implode and get defensive instead? I really do grieve in my heart, and I feel guilty for what I've done to her and to us. How can I express more compassion? I know that would help her diffuse the emotional flood before it gets uncontrollable and help her in the long run to feel better. So one of the problems we have as human beings is we tend to listen with the intent to reply. We really spend very little time trying to listen to what our mate has to say. So my first recommendation is try to suspend what you're trying to reply to and just listen. Not only listen to the words she's saying, but there's a much deeper meaning. It's being able to listen to a person's heart and not trying to change their perspective so that they understand you. But it starts with you trying to understand them. I remember complaining to a friend of mine once that Stephanie just doesn't understand me because she won't listen to me. Or I don't understand Stephanie, because I said that backwards. I don't understand Stephanie. You know, she won't listen to me. And my friend had just pointed out that if I really wanted to understand Stephanie, it wasn't about her listening to me. It was really about me being able to listen to her and just, you know, be willing to hear what she had to say. And I think there's a term called empathic listening, where literally as you listen, all you do is not reflect so much what you hear them saying, but what you hear their heart saying. So if, you know, she says, you know, I feel like, you know, you're always getting your way when it comes to how we handle the kids. You know, the way I might respond to that is, you know, you feel frustrated because I bulldoze you and don't really listen to what you think or give you input as to what ought to happen. And she'll say, yeah, I do feel frustrated by that. And it makes my relationship with the kids more difficult. So you're hurt because it's damaged your relationship with the kids. Well, yeah. And all I'm doing there is I'm reflecting more of the feeling behind what she's saying, even more than the words. What's the intent? So learning that skill of empathic listening is really where compassion begins. And it's not about trying to make your point. You know, it's not because they won't listen to you. It's just suspending your thing. And can you really just listen to them and understand? It is painful and it's difficult. But part of maturity and growth is the ability to listen to another person and sit there in that, in the difference between who we actually are, not feeling like we have to see it the same way. We may not see it the same way. But I feel incredibly honored, at least even when Stephanie doesn't see it as I see it, when she's willing just to sit there with me and listen and hear what I have to say. And hopefully you can do that with your mate. My husband's a sex addict, and we've been in recovery since April. My father's an alcoholic. I recently confided in to our pastor's wife, who's a close friend, about my dad. I feel guilty for talking about it with her, like I've betrayed both my father and my mother. We all go to the same church. So do I have any reasons to feel guilty? You know, I think as long as it depends on obviously what you say to someone. I mean, if you're being really disparaging, if there's slander, yeah, that might be a problem. If you're just sharing to be known, I don't think you necessarily have anything to feel guilty. I think you have to be very careful taking responsibility for your part in all of it when you talk with someone else. I mean, it really needs to be about you probably more than about them and what your struggles are. I mean, if you're just talking about them and they become the point of conversation, then I think in the long run, you know, that may not be as helpful, but I certainly don't think there's, you know, anything wrong with a close friend just talking and sharing life and what our struggles are. I mean, I think, you know, certainly I've talked with my parents at length with friends at our church. Now, if you're doing it with the purpose of manipulating someone and getting them to be upset or take your side, I would say, yeah, that might be a problem. But other than that, no, I don't think personally that that would be any sort of an issue. So hope that helps with that one. Next question. My mate and I struggle with addictive tendencies. Addictions run in our families. My father's an alcoholic, recovered drug addict, but I believe he abuses painkillers currently. Now that my spouse and I are in recovery, it seems painfully clear that both my mother and father are sick. Last week was our son's first birthday party. Three times before the party, and my mom asked me if I was going to take a Xanax to deal with the party. I said no, that I'd be fine. I don't even have any Xanax. I noticed the night before the party, she looked high. I suspected she was taking Xanax. I don't recognize my mother. Now I have my father and my mother using drugs to cope with life. I suspect she takes Xanax to deal with my father's nasty attitudes. He could not wait for my sister to feed her five-week-old baby to start our family dinner. This upset my mom, and she was angry at my sister, too. It's like he's pulling her into his illness more and more, and she is hopeless feeling if she can't beat him, she might as well join him. First off, this is not normal, right, for her to be pushing me to take drugs to handle a party or a family dinner. Well, I mean, obviously I don't think it would necessarily be normal. Sounds to me in a situation like this that she doesn't know, well, she's just offering to handle things the way that she would handle things. I don't know that it's done with malicious intent. Probably to her it's gotten to a place where it sort of seems like a normal way of handling things. So certainly not normal for you. It may actually have gotten to be the new normal for her, and or maybe you're the one that's actually come to a place of a new normal. I think the old normal you used to have is no longer there, so that's probably a bit of the issue. And I think as we move into a new normal, it literally frees us or grants us the ability to see things from a different perspective, and I think that's quite a blessing. So it sounds like you handled that quite well, And I know it's frustrating to watch families go through that. I just hope and pray that, you know, eventually, you know, you'll have the understanding, the insight, the ability to say things to them that may help them in their journey. Now, next question. My wife and I had a fight last week, and one of the things I said that hurt her feelings was that I complained she was doing a lot of work for her own recovery from the affair I've had, but not as much as a couple, as we barely do the EMS calls together on Sunday nights. I was accused of talking like an addict, and she complained that I could arrange sessions with our therapist instead, which would work better for her as a morning person. And so she was upset because although I'm the unfaithful spouse, she's doing much more than me to recover from this mess. I put her in the mess I put her in the first place. And because I made her feel responsible for my own recovery, if we don't do the EMS calls, we don't recover as a couple. How do you gauge someone's recovery? How do I know I'm doing enough, or how do I know I need to do more? A fight like the one we had last week was, for my wife, a sign of emotional relapse. What would you recommend me to do more than what I'm doing? Basically, I have men's fraternity group once a week and NA meetings, not all weeks. Well, I think that, you know, as we do recovery, it's difficult to work somebody else's or do inventory on someone else. And I also think that if you'll remember from the very beginning, we said that the recovery process for the hurt spouse is far more difficult than the recovery process for the unfaithful spouse, simply because the hurt spouse is having to work through all the pain that's been generated as a result of this, while frequently the unfaithful spouse is really experiencing a fresh newness of life. I mean, things potentially are better for them than they have been in decades. And for that reason, they don't necessarily maybe feel the same need. What's probably more important to the unfaithful spouse is the reconciliation of the relationship. There's a lot more ambivalence typically for the hurt spouse regarding reconciling the relationship. So I think couples frequently end up kind of at odds over that particular process. You know, one of the daily check-ins I recommend is just telling her every day what your intentions are. Just say, you know, for instance, it's my intention today to walk in faithfulness toward you and to also walk in sobriety, whatever that intention would be. And I think if you can tell your mate that every day, that means a lot. A second daily check-in that I would do is let her know that you really appreciate the fact that she's willing to go through this process, even 6 months later, that you're still in this thing together, that it means a lot to you that she's still working on this. I think that if she's ambivalent about the EMS call, there may be some just overall ambivalence about it may be more painful for her than many of the other things. So I would just be patient. And when she does what she does, thank her for that. In terms of this being a sign of emotional relapse, potentially maybe a little bit of insensitivity on your part, looking at it from your perspective. And I think that's always the problem that we have with our mate in recovery. We always look at the world through our perspective, thinking that everyone else shares the same point of view, and they don't. So just being able to get out of that and to look and see her point of view, I think, would be helpful for her. And going through that process, that would be one of the things I would also suggest. In terms of whether you need to do more in recovery, if you're growing and you're honestly looking at yourself, if you're doing your step work, I mean, if you're doing that sort of thing, I mean, this is a long-term process. It's not, it's really learning a new lifestyle. It's not about necessarily just trying to quickly change. It's about learning to care about other people. So, you know, practicing what I had suggested in one of the questions earlier, just empathic listening, I think would be another way to go. If you can learn to hear your mate, I can tell you right now, and empathize with her feelings, you will have come a long way when it comes to that recovery process. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. Let's see. Next question. I'm Italian born. I moved to the U.S. 4 years ago. Both my parents are still there. And since my wife discovered I was having an affair and was a sexual addict, part of my recovery started dealing with the wounds of an absent father and overbonded mother. Both caused me emotional pain and instability. We created the conditions for me to develop a sexual addiction during my late teens. I eventually realized that it was time for me to forgive them somehow or find a way to cut the emotional connection that still keeps me attached rather than hold grudges and resentments toward them, which ultimately would turn me into a victim. And I can applaud that. That's a really good point. I can't deny how much I still let my mother use power over me and make me feel guilty or ashamed, which was the norm for the past 30 years. She was emotionally incestuous by sharing intimate sexual things that were hers and my father's, who was instead completely absent and let my mother be both mother and father. I started speaking to my mom again lately after months of silence, and my wife noticed that during our fights last week, I accused her of being controlling like my mother was. She believes that talking to my parents is no good for my recovery and makes me slip into old behavioral habits. If I don't deal with this unhealthy connection, it'll remain unresolved, but it's also difficult to deal with this far away. My wife is dealing with her dad's addiction and behavior face to face, which is painful, and difficult as it is, it's also more effective. What do you recommend? I can do to cut my connection with my parents once and for all. I exclude my parents. Can do any of what my wife and I are doing from what my wife and I are doing, partly because of the language barrier, and partly because of cultural differences, and partly because they barely understand what I've done. But I need to do that for me and for my son's healthy future, for my son and for my wife. So dealing with family of origin is very fascinating. There is a term called intergenerational intimidation, which is really about our ongoing need, maybe the small child in us, to continue to respond to them in ways, because as we did as a child, not knowing how to move beyond. One of the processes that I like to use is what's called legacy work, and I think you could probably do this even from a long-distance perspective. It would require numerous phone calls, but it's really about kind of debriefing your parents on their life, getting a lot of information about them that you probably don't possess at this point. And in the long run, just getting to know them in new ways changes your perspective of how you see them, but it also will, in many ways, as you begin to know them better, rewrite your history and change your understanding of the script and why everything that occurred as a child. I'm not one of those people, unless you've got parents who are very abusive and intrusive, that feels it's necessarily best to totally cut off the relationship with parents. I think some of your best opportunities for growth are going to occur in just learning how to stand up and differentiate from them, being able to be your own person in light of the pressure that they began to put on you to make you conform to the way they've always expected. There are only two primary relationships in our lives, I think, that are really capable of handling that maturing process. And one of them is our family of origin, and the other is our marriage. Those both serve as the crucibles where we can learn to stand up and be exactly who God made us to be, walk in the light, and hang on to kind of that not feeling we need to compromise who we are even as we share with them and when we're different from what they expected. At the same time, it's the place that's probably most difficult for us to learn to accept them okay as is, just the way they are. But it's about a willingness to get to know them. So I would just say you would find, I think, it to be very helpful if you did something like the legacy work that I was just speaking about. And if you'll contact me, I can get you the information on how to begin to do that. Next question. I was reading some of your past articles, also comments left by other readers. The following comment was one of those left by someone who read, "Do you know the truth?" But it could have been written by me since my situation is pretty much the same. I have the same question rolling around in my head. Immediately after reading this, the answer sounds so simple. Choose the Garden of Eden and be happy, and that, because that's the best of the realities you can choose from. However, at the risk of extending this metaphor too far, what about the stench? What happens when the events when events outside your control, like a shift in the wind, makes ignoring that fact that you are surrounded by garbage impossible? My case is of a spouse who refuses to talk about her infidelity, but is working hard to make the Garden of Eden at home. I truly wish I could just focus on her current intentions, but I can't because her current intentions include doing everything possible not to give real, honest, and complete disclosure. These circumstances lead to a toxic environment because I don't feel respected. I don't have a sense of closure, which causes me to dwell and obsess, which leads to a depression and despair. My wife then responds with anger and resentment because I don't respond to her sincere attempts, everything but addressing the infidelity, of making a happy home. I, in turn, resent that she's angry at me because I'm depressed and lost because it's her fault. It's her fault I'm feeling this way. It's a spiraling downward spiral. When do I give up on this? Is there truly hope of living happily long-term while in denial? My question, is there any hope of truly living happily long-term while in denial and pretending normal mode, or am I just really missing the boat here? I really don't know. I need to go back and read that article, honestly, here. It's been a while since I read that, but I wrote it. But I don't know if there's a lot of hope for people who live in denial, only in the sense that it feels to me the probabilities of relapse go up. I've never had anybody relapse because they're weak. I only have people relapse because they think they can do it. They think they're strong. It's just it's too difficult for them to accept the reality maybe of what they're ultimately capable of. Like I say, I don't know that everyone's capable of having an affair, but I do know everyone that's had an affair is capable of having an affair. And intimacy is really that ability, a real relationship, is that ability to let someone else truly know me and to see into me and accept me. And if I can't do that, if I can't let someone know me, if for instance, the wife in this story is incapable, I mean, I appreciate the fact that she's trying to make it better, but you can only work for so long, as I'd say the best of the flesh is the worst of the flesh, before you grow tired and bitter, feeling like, you know, you're not giving as much as they're giving. And, you know, people will try to pay back what they've done in an attempt to make absolution, but really absolution comes through forgiveness. It's your ability to accept him or her, knowing fully what they've done, and extending forgiveness to them. I mean, sometimes I wonder if the problem that people tend to go through, like what you're describing with your mate, is their inability to even receive forgiveness and their continued belief that it's about trying to be good enough. And the only thing I know is that it takes a great deal of maybe individual work and kind of looking at oneself and safe people to talk to. Frequently I find if, you know, the unfaithful spouse doesn't have someone that feels really safe to talk to, it makes it extremely difficult. Maybe for your mate, there's no one safe to talk to. I hope that they can find someone like that. And let's see if there's anything else here. I don't think you're missing the boat here, by the way. Pretend normal to me is just the next step to go forward. So I do hope that he can find someone safe to talk to and that you can move forward. Now, so next question. Hearing you talk about grooming behaviors and explaining it for the first time was pretty earth-shattering for me. I realized that my mate was using this grooming behavior on most other women during our entire marriage. He's narcissistic, and I realized that all of this played a huge part in him having the affair in the first place. So ultimately, grooming behaviors, for those who aren't aware of that, are the behaviors that we do that draw other people to us, where we're really trying to kind of gain validation from other people, because our image and what others think of us becomes so important. And you know, I would propose that love is based far more on pointing people to God, pointing people to places of health, not trying to draw people to us. And so after his affair, when my pain was still very raw and when I was in the mode of reacting and trying to call him out on his behavior, I got the full force of his rage as he consistently turned things around to make it my fault. It nearly destroyed me before I even realized what was happening. Once I finally started educating myself and learning that confronting narcissism head-on is an effort in futility, God gave me the courage and strength to take a step back from the craziness. Now that I've started changing my own step, these have settled way down. However, he is now using this same grooming behavior on me. It feels like he's trying to use it to manipulate me, to throw me off from my own needs, to face the fallout from his affair head-on, deal with it, work through it, etc. Whenever I do try talking to him about his affair, what his affair has cost me, and what I need from him to help me heal, he manages to turn everything around to make it all about him and his losses, because as he sees it, I just can't let go and move on. I don't even know how he does it, but he just is really good at making me look bad and making himself out to be the victim. Is it common for an unfaithful spouse to use grooming behaviors on the hurt spouse to avoid the work of healing? I realize that I have to find a non-confrontational way of dealing with him. So how can I stop this cycle? If it's always being all about him. So it depends a little bit on the goal, and even someone like you're describing, I think, can learn the concept I mentioned earlier of sort of empathic listening. It's what's the goal of a relationship, and how do you begin to accept the other person and get to know them? You're right in terms of being non-confrontational with someone like this. And I don't know, let me go back a little bit. When you talk about grooming behaviors, the one thing I don't know is his motivation for why he's doing and responding as he's acting. It may be manipulative in nature, and I certainly can understand why you would look at it that way. It may also be his best shot at what he thinks it's supposed to look like. even though that may be a bit uninformed. Again, I don't know, but I would at least be willing to maybe consider other potential possibilities as you look at it, but be careful. And I think that there's a good book you might want to try reading together if he's willing to do that, and it talks a little bit about this process. It's called The Marriage Benefit, and let's see if I can find that here, the name of the author. It would be something that might be a good read for you in the sense that it talks about the need to begin to be intimate, to talk, and it's really not about infidelity, so we might be able to tolerate looking at it from that paradigm a lot better if talking about the affair is still something he gets really defensive about. So that may be another route to take with him. And unless you can get the two of you working on communicating and kind of pursuing a different goal in the communication, I think it'd be really difficult. I would also say that to do that, you may really need the help of a third party to keep it calm enough to be able to have that discussion. So I'd highly recommend doing that in the context of marriage therapy if you'd be open to just to that process. Let's see, friend in need. Hi, Rick. Let me start by thanking God for guiding my wife and I this far after the traumatic events that occurred almost a year ago. After a year, I find myself in a spot where I feel God finally revealing how the very difficult road my wife and I went through can be put to use. I have a friend who's been struggling with infidelity in his marriage. After going back and forth on the issue of disclosure, he finally decided to go forth. Ground zero happened Friday night, and he's been texting me asking for advice. The only thing I keep telling him is to trust God and pray. I also referred him to ARC and EMS. I wish I could do more. Is there anything I could do or say to assist him the most in this very difficult time? Thank you. You know, just in terms of disclosure, remember the 24-hour rule. I think that if someone could speak to his wife and let her know that there is life after this, I mean, most likely what they need is some encouragement and more than anything, hope. I think some of the resources, 20 most common mistakes, those might be useful if you've got a copy of All You Ever Wanted to Know About Infidelity. That would be probably a very good thing to give them. Certainly would have them take the affair analyzer. That would probably give some very specific recommendations to her that I think may be able to give her some directions to take. You know, the main thing for her, I believe, is it's so incredibly disorienting and frightening, and just having someone who's already been there and understands, I think, is huge. So if she's willing to talk to someone, I think that would help as much as anything. And, you know, maybe she would be willing to talk to your wife. You might pray about that. And if you could meet with them both as a couple and just share your story, that's something else that they might find useful. I'm glad to hear that God's been able to take something that was really difficult, still is, it sounds like, at times, but worked something good from that. So that's encouraging. Let's see. What is normal sex? My spouse and I have done 3 months of no intercourse to help clear out our old perceptions of sex and give me time to heal. I'm the hurt spouse. I've a history of painful intercourse and chronic yeast infections. I went to the endocrinologist, and he diagnosed me with a thyroid infection, and the OB has given me some hardcore run-on yeast infection medication. So we've not had sex for 3 months, and I don't have hormone issues and no yeast infection. But still, when we had sex this morning, I felt the old familiar burning on the outside. This was not normal, right? Burning is not normal. How am I going to figure out what's causing this? I'm trying to put pieces together, and I know at the start of my new sexual relationship, I never had burning or pain, but as I settle, I think my overall anxiety kicks back, my body tenses, then it's back to the familiar patterns of sex and burning. It's making me crazy. What do you suggest? I finally mentally wanted to have sex, and then it hurt. I have a second association with sex because I'm so used to this burning and pain accompanying it, and I'm also still unable to have an orgasm. I feel so broke and really sad about this. I'm pretty sure if I started having sex with a new partner, it would not be painful. Why is this? I want to have good sex with my spouse. So this area is a little bit complicated, and I don't know whether you would have burning with another partner or you wouldn't. I think that there's a lot of times with sex, people have performance anxiety and anticipatory anxiety, and anxiety is typically the culprit when it comes to anorgasmia and sometimes painful intercourse. I know that if that problem persists, there are several things you might want to do. You're going to need to talk with somebody who understands a little bit about sexual dysfunction. There are some great exercises that help with relaxation and getting rid of that anticipatory anxiety, which I think would go a long way to helping in this process. And, you know, I believe that there's a good chance that the burning may have a little bit to do with that anxiety also. It can be almost more of a psychosomatic response. Not saying that it is, just know that it really could be. And once you begin to relax and I think some of the wounds begin to heal, I'd be really surprised if you didn't find that getting much better. But that's one of the things I would certainly talk with your therapist about. I suspect they can give you some good directions on how to begin to heal from that. Now, my spouse is an addict, and it's been about 8 months since full disclosure. In the course of his recovery, I learned a lot about myself and that I numb out and have trouble feeling my feelings. I've been doing a lot of awareness work, but still am stuck. Is there anything else I can do? Is this numbness part of my recovery process because of the trauma of my spouse's affair? I don't understand why it's so hard to feel and identify my feelings. For many people, self-awareness and being aware of feelings is just something they have never done. So I believe doing self-awareness exercises, beginning to identify your feelings, is critical to the recovery process. It's difficult to begin to be intimate with your mate if you've never been able to be honest with yourself and just know what's going on with you. I mean, how do you even share where your heart is or what you're feeling, or how are you going to be aware of how it's impacting you if you don't have that ability to kind of stop and check in with yourself? And if you don't have the ability not only to notice the feelings, but then to do what's necessary to hang on to yourself and still maintain your own sense of being. So by doing the self-awareness exercises, I think you're doing what's necessary. One of the things that I always try to do is get people in the long run to share feelings. You know, the cool thing about a conversation that's feeling-based is there's no way that you and your mate can disagree simply because, you know, our feelings just are, and it's the lowest common denominator. There's not anything you have to do in the long run, you know, or agree about the feelings. They're going to be what they're going to be. So hopefully that helps with that. Next, flooding. we've not had sex for 3 months. This was fine for me because I didn't have any desire to be sexually active. The past week, I've been feeling a desire to be with my mate. As soon as I decided to bring it up to him, I was slammed with the pain of his affair, and all the same doubts came crashing back to me that he was lying about not being sexually attracted to her, that he's lying when he says it didn't mean anything, that he wrote to her in his romantic emails, that he's lying, that he wasn't lustful, that our bond was nothing to him because he continued to have an affair from the very start of the relationship, from the marriage and the birth of our first child. Mostly, it was the screaming doubts that he's lying about what was going on during the affair, and I can't trust him. What the heck is that all about? That's a great question, and I think any time we begin to think about recommitting and, you know, moving back into a relationship, there's the part of us, because we always have two sides to us, that is protective and immediately goes back into the same mantra that it's been doing before in the past. I think that you're probably going to have to develop a way of addressing those fears as they come up. And it's not about arguing with them real time. It may be about doing some exercises to identify the false belief and the true belief, what you're going to choose to believe. I think maybe mindfulness and staying in the moment, making a list of the things that you've seen since recovery began that counteract what you believe to have been back in the past. A lot of times, our re-engagement with another human being is a decision of our heart. I don't know that I could have ever been good enough to deserve Stephanie coming back and being with me. There is a place where she chose, you know, after seeing the work I was doing, she chose to love me. And she chose to give herself to me regardless. She wasn't playing the game of was I worthy, was I not worthy anymore. I mean, I think the doubts for her, I mean, there's always a risk. To love in the long run is to risk. I don't say that, you know, it's always safe to reengage. I mean, it depends a lot on what you've seen in that person through time. But the biggest battle I think we fight when it comes to reengagement, when it comes to recommitment, is really the battle with ourselves. And, you know, are we willing, I think, in the long run, to be intimate? And I think it's about keeping your own inventory, and you always have to stay focused, as C.S. Lewis says, you know, keeping that one nostril keenly attuned to your own inner cesspool. And as you do that, I think you'll find that it'll be less about him and more about you. I think about a conversation I had with a client last week that was pretty fascinating, and in it, she and her husband had been sexual for the first time in well over a year, not just 90 days. And she said there was a great deal of fear and intrepidation as she began to move into that part of their relationship again. He had invited her. She had accepted. But she said, interestingly enough, that instead of feeling the anger and the rage that she had anticipated, all she recognized is that so much of what had driven her internal fear and her internal rage was her own sense of guilt. And that was the big surprise that she experienced from that entire thing. She felt incredibly guilty about her own behavior. And she'd never recognized that what was behind her rage had been guilt. She'd always thought it was fear. But she realized there were other aspects to it. But she also found it was really tender when they came back together, in the sense that for the first time, she was able to stop looking at him and just began to sort of enjoy the process. She said, thankfully, they went very slow, but they had a lot of success with it. So I would, you know, continue doing your own individual work, and just understand this, it is difficult. And if you're not quite ready, you know, you may find that may be a little bit of the fear. give yourself permission to take time. And, you know, if your mate loves you, I suspect he'll also give you that permission to take the necessary time to grow from this. See, Rick, I'm the unfaithful spouse. It's been 50 days from full disclosure since I'd only done a partial disclosure a year ago. My wife wanted 30 days of not talking, which I honored. It's been 15 days since we last spoke. I've tried to contact her via email and text and phone. She hasn't responded. I'm caught in between continuing to give her space or increasing the emails and phone calls. Although I understand the devastation that she's going through, I don't want her to think I'm not trying enough. She is the love of my life, and I'm working with my spiritual life. I don't want to lose her. What should I do? You know, whether or not you lose your mate, I recognized, you know, when I went into recovery that the last thing I deserved was my marriage. And my focus never was to save the marriage. My focus was ultimately to become who I needed to be as a man. And I wanted to love my wife, but I didn't want to live for my wife. I wanted to live for God. And I can tell you the most important thing you can do, regardless of what happens with your mate or your marriage, is that you continue working your program, that you continue walking and being who God wants you to be. Hopefully, you know, as I told Stephanie, you'll become someone that your wife would really want to be with in the long run. But I suspect, you know, given the fact that you went for a long period of time, not being honest with her, that it would take, you know, at least that long again of her seeing you continuing to stay the course, regardless of how she responds to you. So you need to be able to grant her, you know, probably almost a year. I mean, if she can see you continuing to walk the same course a year down the line, even though she hasn't responded to you, she might begin to believe at that point that you're serious and that you truly want to get your act together, or maybe you're getting your act together, that this isn't about just trying to get her back. My suspicion is it's frightening to her to think about trying to reengage with you if, in the long run, she feels like you're doing it in an attempt to win her again. But if she sees you continuing to walk this path, regardless of how she's responding, that would be the one thing I suspect that would begin to give her some hope. So next question, emotions and sex. My wife and I have not been having sex for a while. I'm the unfaithful spouse, and due to the emotional devastation I caused, there's no way she wanted to get close to me during this time. Over these few months in which we've both been working on a recovery, she started feeling the desire to be with me again, but she's also seen she's also been struggling with emotional flooding and pain that was awakened by that desire because of the affair, humiliation, disbelief about my story, resentments, emotional detachment, rejection, sense of insecurity, fear of being vulnerable and fooled and made the fool of again. Nonetheless, she and I had sex this morning, and it was so great that I could be with her. And I feel a great sense of responsibility. After a long time, my wife decided to put herself into my hands again and to be vulnerable. She's also struggled with not being able to reach an orgasm and the feeling of painful intercourse. She feels broken and humiliated. You can imagine, at this juncture, she's very exposed and vulnerable. I go to NA meetings and men's fraternity meetings every week. There are times when I don't go to NA, and during the last fight, I noticed my ego and attitude were taking over, which made her feel even more unsafe. It was, she said, as though just because things are better, I stopped being tolerant, loving, compassionate, as though I was taking advantage of her. I need to know, what is it that I can do to avoid, how do I keep that from happening, especially now that my wife may feel more vulnerable and exposed? I also need help to express to her from the deepest part of my heart the gratitude and honor I have for her decision but sometimes I screw things up with words. You know, I think a little bit, like I said in the previous answer, you've got to work your own program, and Scripture says that's kind of working out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For your mate, knowing that you're pursuing the right thing, the next right thing, that it's really not even about trying to save the marriage, but it's just about you trying to become who you need to be. It's you addressing the issue. You love her, but you don't necessarily do all of this for her, but you do want her. I think that just letting her know straight up how appreciative you are that she would be with you, I would encourage her. I would tell her that you're more than willing to be patient. I would put no sense of demand. And in fact, anything you can do to take off any demand. You know, when I have a husband who's willing to tell his wife that, you know, hey, you know, he'll take, she can have as long as she needs to heal, that means a great deal. That she means more to you than sex. Those are the messages that ultimately I think are very helpful for her, and hopefully that's something that you'll be able to offer her in the process. But continue, I think, in your process of doing your program, because if not, we automatically, I believe, if we're not doing that recalibration of our heart and our soul and our mind, and we're keeping a right focus, we naturally go back to the default mode, as you were talking about, of being more self-centered. So I would just exhort you, continue to make good choices and to live in recovery. And next, my husband, the unfaithful one, and I had a pretty bad day a week ago when he tried to minimize what his affair partner did and tried spying or tried to spin the affair so that she didn't look as bad. That really upset me, since he had written letters to me saying that her compliments at church, he was the choir director, on his abilities, and he said that her compliments were over the top, and her stares at him during various meetings, etc., is what made him start noticing her in the first place. She also encouraged him to go further and further in the affair and told me, when I found out, that it was because her husband was preoccupied with graduate school and she wanted my husband's time and attention, but that she never loved him. After that incident of him continuing to defend her honor, I couldn't cuddle or have sex with him for several days. In fact, he slept in the other room. But then after a few days, I asked him to come sleep in our bed, which he did. He went promptly to sleep. I undressed and slept nude beside him that night, but he didn't notice until the next morning, and he didn't respond to me except to make a silly remark. Then he got out of bed. That night, I asked him to give me a back massage, and he did. I was also undressed at that point, but when he finished, he was not aroused at all. He made some stupid excuse, but I felt and still feel that his non-reaction just indicates that he really doesn't desire me and that he's just play-acting about loving me. Please give me some insight. Well, I think that that assumption may or may not be right. I mean, my first thought would be I really never know what another person's thinking without really asking, and there are lots of reasons guys don't get an erection. It may be that he doesn't feel safe, just like at times maybe you don't feel safe. For a guy, if there's still hurt, and maybe, I'm not even saying it's necessarily right, but he's feeling really misunderstood, or falsely accused, even if he wants to be a certain way, you may find that it's difficult to be aroused, because there's still a lack of connection between the two of you. I think that whenever there's an ability to come to the place where we can see it the same way, it makes it much easier to be with our mate. But it is true that if that lack of connection is there, then he still may be having troubles, and that doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't desire you. It may be that he doesn't, you know how to get over the hurt that's been created by what happened over this past week. I would, again, recommend in this sort of situation, if there's a third party you can talk to and process through that, I think it would be really good. You might see if the two of you can actually sit down and have what, you know, I call those rational conversations about that whole event. You may not see it the same way. And it's still the ability to hear how the other person's seeing it. That doesn't mean if he's, you know, when you talk about defending her honor, I find that an interesting concept. I know that Stephanie and I had a lot of trouble with this. And it wasn't that I was necessarily trying to defend Martha's honor. What I was trying to do ultimately is take 100% responsibility for what I did. I was naive enough at that point not to understand that, you know, as I was trying to take responsibility for my actions, you know, I was dismissing her part of the responsibility, which was really hurtful. And for Stephanie, it felt like I was ultimately trying to defend my affair partner. I don't know if that's the case in this sort of situation, but I can tell you if the reason he's doing this in the long run is because he wants to take responsibility, then that would be a really good thing. That's the sort of thing you want to see in your mate. And I think it, you know, this sort of what you're describing here is just going to require more talking between the two of you and trying at least to come to a point of understanding, but also the ability for him to know that you care and he matters to you, and an ability for him, for you to come to the place of knowing that you really matter to him, and for you to work through that hurt. If when you do come to the place, one last thing, where you separate and you go to separate rooms, if there's already been a lot of hurt, sometimes it takes several days for it to feel safe enough and to feel reconnected. And it sounds like there's probably going to need to be some talking for that to occur. Well, that concludes our time for the day. I want to thank everybody for writing the questions. We had some great questions today. And I look forward to being able to talk with everybody next week to healing.